I've drawn a Hebrew letter over against the left shoulder. And we must remember that this picture is in reverse on this episcope. And therefore we must go to a reverse position of the letter. Now actually, the man on the card is already drawn the wrong way round. So that we have to leave the man in that position and reverse the letter. And you'll then see that the long horizontal on the letter represents the man's body, and the two little parts, would you like to indicate those for me, Ken? On the olive there.
Oh, yes.
Yes. The two little parts there represent the arm up and the arm down. It's the Hebrew letter Aleph, which is the same as the Greek Alpha, our letter A. If we do a very rapid cursive form of it, running down the diagonal, and through, it'll make our letter A. Yes, we have to reverse it.
Yeah.
Now, that letter, the first letter of all alphabetical languages, signifies the absolute. The second letter of the alphabet, the B, the beta or beth, signifies a boundary or house. Beth is Hebrew for a house. And the idea of being is circumscription. Every being, in order to be, must be bound. So B, Beth, Beta, means boundary, and the letter before it is Aleph, Alpha, A. And this man, the magician, represents the being who is conscious of the dialectical processes of his own essence. So we'll have to consider the two parts that represent the hand raised up and the hand down as two forces acting on the diagonal. Now, if you imagine them pressing on the diagonal, would you like to begin?
Sorry.
Yes, take the thick one as the diagonal, and the other two as forces pressing upon it. Then the diagonal must begin to rotate. You can easily see that if we take a bar of wood and apply two forces to it, then the bar must begin to rotate. And the concept of existence is based on the concept of a rotation of a force. So, in this picture of the magician, we have to remember that the man is indicating heaven and earth simultaneously. You can find pictures of Gautama Buddha in what is called earth witnessing position, and another one, heaven witnessing position. And if you hold up your two hands, the left up and the right down, your left signifies your intellection, and the right signifies your will applying itself. So when left up, right down, is the position of that magician. And it means look up for your reason, and look down to apply. And magician is from the root mag mug, which means dry, primary will. So the magician is the man who has discovered the potential of his own being. A man who has discovered what Caesar discovered, the cause is in the will. So this particular card represents, in the magician, the man who is reflexively, self-consciously aware that he is the cause of his own destiny. And in order to obscure this fact from the populace, the priests in Egypt and Greece concealed this drawing of the man up and down in the form of a very rapid cursive form, which became that letter Aleph or Alpha. Over the man's head is a number 8 on its side, which is the symbol mathematically for infinity and eternity. And the idea is the reciprocal feeling of the two parts of your being. You have a volitional aspect and an intellectual aspect. And the will, as it's moving, is always moving to an object, and therefore towards objectification, ideation, limitation, circumscription, bondage. But every idea which is a limitation gives a stimulus to the will to do something else. So if a man paints a certain picture, halfway through that picture he will get an idea for another picture. If a man writes a novel, somewhere through the novel he'll get an idea for another novel. So that although every idea is a limitation on the will, it nevertheless gives a stimulus to the will and enables the will therefore to find some other object to will into. Now, if we remember that, the figure of the manus, left up means intellection, right down means application. The letter ala or alpha there is merely a very, very simplified form of that man. The number 8 over his head is eternity and infinity, and signifies the feeding in of the intellection and will into each other. They feed each other. On the table there is a chalice, and that chalice is another form of the number 8. If you cut off the 8 on the outside half circles and then stand it on its edge, it will represent that chalice. You just draw the 8 vertically, cut off the top and the bottom, and that is the chalice. And again, the chalice, the Holy Grail, signifies this being of ours, into which at one end intellection comes, formal energy, and at the other end primary urge, will or mag. Down below there are some roses and lilies. These symbols of the rose and the lily didn't appear in Christianity until the Renaissance, but before then, of course, the rose did belong to Venus, and the lily, because the word lily means to play about, to take it easy, to relax, consider the lilies, they toil not, etc. The lily, as purity, signifies there is none so pure as the purified. It's used in the coat of arms of the French, because the concept to a rational nation like the French of play is antithetical to their own being. Reason is essentially rigid and play is relaxed. The rose means to develop, and the lily means there is none so pure as the purified. If you play about empirically, you will discover something. So that the lily, in say Delida, actually means literally for sport. So that when Samson, the son of the sea, son of the sea, is trapped by Delida, it means he was playing about. The lexicon definition of Delilah means to let the hair hang down limply. And the idea in the Samson story is that his own hair, which means power, as he hung it down and gazed upon the play of his power, it fascinated him. And in the fascination with the behavior of his own power, he became blinded to his real nature. He became involved in the objectifications of his own will. And for sport, Delilah therefore lost his power, and it is not until he is blinded that he realizes that playing is dangerous, because in identification one loses oneself. Thereupon he has to pull down the temple, which is the structure of time, time play, created by his own power. Then he releases himself from the objectification of his own will. So if we just look very rapidly over that again, we've got the magician, left out intellection, right down application will. Letter Aleph Alpha A signifies that man. The 8 over it signifies infinity and eternity, and reciprocal feeding of intellection and will. The chalice is the same thing, representing now the body of man on earth. The temple of God is with man. This physical body is the alchemist stone that has to be transmuted. Transmuted by this reciprocal feeding of the lower urge into the intellect and the intellect into the lower urge. And the rose means develop, and the lily means to play and to get experience, to be tainted and then to purify oneself. There's none so pure as to purify. I think that will do for now, and that one can, then we can discuss some of the wider implications. Mm-hmm. On the table there are the other significances of the Torah pack. We did go into the outline of those partially last week, in the ordinary four suits of cards. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll right way round there. There's a little letter there. If I draw that letter, the diagonal is going this way. This way, and there's one hand pointing up, that's the left one, one pointing down, that's the right. Now, if I draw it like this, if I draw the hand up the diagonal, down, and go to the other one. I haven't made a cursive form, but if I want to write very, very quickly, I will write through it like that. Down the diagonal, up and across. And then if I look at the way the Greeks write their alpha, they write it simply like that, straight over and down again. That's the cursive form of the alpha. Now if you look at the lowercase, the small letter A, as we write it with a ligature coming up from another letter, that's simply a binding stroke, we ignore that. We go round like that and then down. If we went like that, we get exactly the same thing. Our letter A is sort of circle with another line added to it, which becomes a ligature to the next letter. And that is a round form. You all know the sign of Taurus in the zodiac. And Taurus is the letter alpha, turned up with the horns up. So if we write like this, that represents Taurus, the bull. That's the ox, the emasculated bull. And, you know, Taur means to turn, to get in the grooves, keep rotating. You get a bull which won't behave itself, you emasculate it, and then you can put it to turn an arm or a wheel and draw water. So that any being whatever that can be put into a groove is called Taur in Hebrew. Taur means a turtle dove. Notice that in turtle you've got the same root, T-U-R. The dove coos and is very affectionate and represents the reproductive principle in life, which keeps the wheel of life going. Therefore, Taur means a turtle dove, as well as an ox or anything else. In centaur, the idea is of the singing horse also going around in a group. Toro, the Spanish bull, refers to this emasculated bull, the ox, going round. So if we draw the face of an ox very rapidly, the horns, and then the face, and make a cursive form like that, that turned on its side is the letter alpha, and is our less small letter A. Now if we look at the Egyptian form of it in its capital form, the letter A, upside down, drawn that way. Just draw an ordinary capital A upside down and put eyes into it, nose, and then draw the ears on the side, and you've got the original glyph from which it is derived. Now if you turn that letter A the other way up, the way we call the right way up, it is a drawing of an eagle. So you just had a beak on the top of it, and the two bottom parts of the legs. And the eagle signifies the intellect. And the bull signifies the lower urge. And the problem is for the intellect to control the lower urge and make it do as it's told. We have a certain amount of vital energy in us that tends to misbehave. It is the function of the intellect to act down upon it, that's the ego, telling the ox what to do. There's two of the figures in the Revelation of St. John. So if we take the idea of the bull as Taur, as emasculated turner and water drawer or worker, and the inversion of it is eagle or high-flying intellect, and we can see that they represent the two poles of being, in which the left hand pointing up is the eagle flying, and the right hand pointing down is the urge pointing to the earth, so that the ox used for plowing is an ox deprived of its own urge tenancy, and subjected to the will of an intellectual being, namely man. So in this concept of condition shown in this card, we have primary will, which is Mag, the Persian book. Remember that the Magi are the wise men from Chaldea, and they are concerned with the precipitation of their own will. The primary Mag, to move, to measure, to evaluate, establishing itself, and then fixing itself, it mag, ik, at the end means to ratify, to establish itself. So that the man who can establish his own will is making magic. To say magic is already a corruption of the generation of the effort. It should be mag. There should be an aspirated T there. Something like the loch, or the stomach, as it used to be pronounced, the mach. And stomach is this mach root. So mach means this primary effort, and the ik at the end means the intellectual control function. So Umagit means intellectual control of one's own will. We said last week that the termination Kyan means continuous activity. So Magi Kyan, the magician, means he who continuously formulates his own will. And we also said that the man who does not formulate his own will is going to have it formulated for him by somebody else. Because in this world we cannot be free of another being unless we are first free of the tendencies of our own nature. We know that all advertising and so on is no more than the application of primary rules of the conditioning technique of, say, the Pavlov reflex. You find out what somebody likes and you tie something to it that they haven't got, and you'd like to sell them, and then they go out and buy it. This is called conditioning their reflexes. It really means you take their primary urge and set up a form for the urge to flow into. That is the technique of salesmanship. Pavlov merely did some 19th century experiments to prove something. It was the standard daily technique of the Egyptian, Greek, and Persian, Babylonian priests. In the Book of the Dead you can see there, and in the Book of the Opening of the Mouth, you can see there the whole technique laid out, but in hieroglyphic form. They had three languages: hieroglyphic for the priest to read, hieratic for keeping the business accounts of the temple, and demotic for talking nonsense to the people. Isis, Osiris, and Horus represent the three sides of a right-angled triangle to the Egyptian priests, and the things that could be done with it, what we call today vector analysis in topographical psychology, for instance, is no more than the application of those three gods. So we have to consider the whole problem for us is to get the energy that we have and find a worthwhile form, and then persuade the energy we have to flow into that form. And in order to do so, we have to realize that primary energy has a purpose of its own. It says on one occasion in the Bible, no man can be continent except God wills it. That means to say that there are certain forces in a man which are not individual. They're running through him, and he cannot do anything about those forces because they are forces of the universal. They're greater than he is. If he tries to control them, he will be defeated and lose face with himself. He may become negative, he may become impotent through fear. The chief force, of course, is the reproductive force, the way of the Pitris of the Hindus, the force of the ancestors coming through to project the next generation. A man who tries ignorantly to stop that force manifesting itself will come up against the realization that he hasn't got the power to stop it. It will distort and become a toxin in his body if he manages to inhibit it in the wrong way. So it has to be discovered how to get that primary drive, the mark, into the ik, that is, into the appropriate intellectual form. All the modern psychologists are concerned with what they call sublimation only. That is, the lifting of a primary urge, essentially egotistic, antisocial, into a form where it can be related and adjusted to the directions of other worlds. The modern terminology has, in many ways, obscured the real issue, because the real issue is a very simple one. You have your own primary urge with which you were born. It existed actually in utero and determined the development of the egg into the human being which you became. That primary urge, when it causes the birth — birth means to be flung out of the house — when it is striving to get out, it is striving egotistically. You know, to be born is to be carried, and to be given birth to is to be kicked out. What Freud called the omnipotence fantasy in utero is the concept that the child has in utero, inside the mother, that everything is laid on, and therefore it is heaven. And whatever need it has, it will be automatically fulfilled as it needs it. After birth, after it has been kicked out of the house, it discovers that things do not get supplied, so its omnipotence fantasy is challenged by the new situation. And straight away the child not having any vocabulary other than screaming, uses its technique, the only one it's got, of screaming and kicking and so on, as a sign language to try to compel the environment to fulfill all its desires in the same way that it had them when it was in the mother. Now, it discovers that frequently the adults round about it do not fulfill its wishes. The primary urge then begins to experiment, and it goes through a stage called the Terence stage. Terence was a man who noticed that children start being magical. He called it the magical period, when children start using every trick they could possibly find, their body positions, arching their backs, screaming, rolling on the floor, all in an attempt to coerce the environment into supplying it in the same way it was supplied before birth. And it discovers that its magic doesn't work in general because it is an external magic. And gradually it begins to disbelieve in the possibility of magic because the technique it has used has not succeeded. And the reason is a very simple one, that the magic it was trying to use was purely ritualistic. That is to say, external. It made gestures and it screamed. It acted on the external of the adults it was trying to influence, through the ears and the eyes and so on. Whereas real magic acts directly on the will centre. If you've ever nursed anyone who's been ill at all, you know very well that the most essential thing you could have to help that person is an absolute confidence that that person can recover. It doesn't really matter what medicines you give them, or if you give them none. One old doctor friend of mine, who was very, very enthusiastic years ago, has given up giving them anything at all, except a bit of licorice water and various colouring matters and so on, because he's discovered that the expectancy of the result is more important than what he gives. In other words, there's a suggestive process going on. He has discovered that magic is the rule. If he can give confidence to the patient begins to improve, even if there is something organically wrong. And this is all under the heading of the real meaning of magic, namely the application of the will and the formulation by the will of some suitable condition that you would like to appear, and then the continuous leading of the will into that situation. And remember, you cannot coerce the will, you cannot flog the will into doing anything. You can only titillate the will in the direction it is going. Promise it something that it wants, then it will move. If you promise it something it doesn't want, it will not. This is why so many people are resistant to cures. Why, if you get all the best medical treatment and apply it to a certain person, that person does not improve because they do not will to improve. Sometimes recovering from a disease may mean going back to work when you've already managed to do very well without it. I had a letter the other day from a fellow in a rehabilitation centre. And he's only been there a fortnight, and he says, I'm going to leave here, I'm improving. If he improves as much as he's capable of, he will be deprived of £2 a week, and he'll be turned loose on the labour market. And he's sufficiently conscious to know that, so he's decided to leave and change and try another way. Now, he's been trying similar ways for a few years, some of them much worse than that, to his own discomfort. Now, initially, he was a very bad asthmatic, and when he came to see me, it was on account of very bad and frequent attacks of asthma, and I could not persuade him to drop it unless I showed him a better technique. You see, the will not go in any direction, it will only go in the direction that it wants to go. So what you have to do is find out where it wants to go, and then tie something to it, like the advertiser does. In this case, I showed him that he actually made himself ill when he was at home on his own, when there was nobody there to watch him, when his illness had no real purpose. The first thing was to get him to confine his illness to public demonstrations, and then to wean him gradually till he dares to be well in public. And this is tremendously important, that you've got to realize that a human will, like the will of an animal, has already a bias, a movement in a certain direction. Most of the philosophers examining say that the truth of the universe is hedonism. That is to say, the will is pursuing pleasure. Now, it is only true, providing you don't corner the will by a trick. You can actually corner the will by a technique and make it desire something other than pleasure, which we will call happiness. People distinguish between happiness and pleasure. And if you can make it desire happiness instead of pleasure, you can then begin to make it desire to be good, which is quite different from pursuing the pleasant. And you can then make it begin to desire to be truthful by tying good and the pursuit of it to truth. So you have to take something that it wants to do already and tie to it something else that it's doubtful about and colour it in such a way that it seems to be a step in the direction in which it wants to go. And the whole of that process is magic. If you work it on yourself, the auto magic, you have to say, where am I trying to go? And then, what will conduce to my getting there in the most economic manner? And you then make an analysis of the necessary steps to where you want to go. The simplest way of doing it is you get a large piece of paper and you write it on it, a little description of where you are now. At the other end of the paper, you write your ultimate condition that you'd like to reach, and then you draw a line straight across the two. You then start thinking of methods of getting there. And the methods fall into two, either direct methods or indirect. If it's a direct method, you write it on the line. If the method is indirect, you decide whether it's positively indirect or negatively. That is to say, whether the thing that you've got to do to get there, a precondition, is good as well, or whether it's bad as well. For instance, if you want to get free from a toothache, you may go to a dentist and you can decide whether to have it filled or extracted. If you have it extracted, well, you'll save future bills on that tooth, but you'll have a gap. You have to decide how aesthetically built you are, whether you like what is called a vanity tooth or something, you see, or a salesman's tooth. It may not be vanity, it may be the sense of the daily salesman. Whichever you decide on, you have to commit yourself to that. If it's an extraction, it's a negation, you're going to lose something. So you write it below the line. The aim is freedom from toothache, and one of the measures is go to a dentist, that's a positive on the line, and under the line, have tooth extracted, that's a negative. Another one is have tooth filled, that's a positive, you've still got the tooth. So you can make this threefold analysis of all the steps between where you are and where you want to get. Now, every great leader in the world has used this technique, the identical technique. It doesn't matter whether they're great villains, like Hitler or Napoleon, or great men in the real sense. They've always had this clarity of mind, the ability to define, that is where I am now, I'm such a man, with such equipment, such talents, and that is where I want to get, draw the line, right on the line of positive steps towards it that are immediate, and then write the means to the end that are not immediately getting there but have to be done, like being polite to a lady on the door if you want to sell her a brush. The politeness is a means. Now that would be a positive one if you say, I'm a brush salesman. Selling brushes is my object. The first positive step is to go to houses, knock on knockers. Next one is when the lady opens the door, you put your foot in it before she has time to shut it. That is a positive one. This is the kind of analysis that has to be done, not only in little things, but in big things. Supposing we write down, I am immortal. I would like to be an immortal. You have to define what immortality consists in. Immortality consists in the ability to resist the forces of disintegration. Mortal means breaking up. Immortal means not breaking up. So you have to define, along that line, somehow, a technique of self-integration so that you can resist the forces that act on you from outside. Supposing a man defines something as worthwhile, doesn't matter what it is. I've got any technical experts here, for instance, who think that something is worthwhile, who wouldn't mind exposing themselves in a little discussion, and then we could do a practical demonstration of this kind of thing. Is there anybody who would like to go from a place to a place, where he is, to another place? And then we could use the diagram in a practical demonstration.
Well, that'd be the case of me starting in photography.
The photography?
Yeah.
Well, supposing we... How much do you know about it now?
Very much.
In actual fact, you could define, couldn't you, what you know about photography?
Yes,
ma'am. Now, where would you like to get to?
Well, I'm attempting to do in home portraiture.
Home portraiture. So we write home portraiture over there and we draw a line. Now, on the line, we've got to do the immediate steps. For instance, equipment. We must have some of that, mustn't we?
Yes.
We must have equipment, a place, and some persons to photograph, mustn't we?
Yes.
We write those on the line as immediate steps to it. And then we have these positive and negatives. You have to define now what kind of people you would like to photograph, wouldn't you?
Yes.
Do you know what kind they are?
Yes.
What the kind would they be?
Living in large estates, near studios and such.
Yes.
Working class people that live in the large housing estates.
Oh, yes. Well, now, you'd have to have an approach, wouldn't you? Now, what method of approach would it be? Would it be a positive one or a negative one? That is, would you go and start contacting particular people and saying to them, can I photograph you?
Oh, yes.
Yes? That would be a positive way. You'd write that above the line.
Go and knock on their doors.
That's just a mediating step towards photography, isn't it?
Yes.
But it is a positive one, and you would do it that way.
Well, if you don't do that, you don't take the photographs.
Mm-hmm. Well, there may be a negative way of doing it as well. I mean, I'm not recommending it, but there is a possibility of doing something on somebody in such a way that they'd ask you to photograph them.
Oh,
isn't that? Yes. But in this case, you're not going to write any such negatives.
No,
mm-hmm.
I think so. I don't think I have any other ideas in mind.
No. I know a photographer, a commercial photographer, who works entirely negatively. He deliberately creates accidents for other people. And he's always there with his camera. He's a press photographer. There aren't enough accidents, and you can't sell ordinary pictures, they've got to be newsy. So he creates accidents, you see, and then he photographs them, and then he says to the person, lucky I was here, do you mind if I use your picture? And they say, yes. You see the idea? That's a negative technique. But both ways are used. So you see a simple illustration of the way of doing that. Now, every time you clarify where you want to go and the steps to it, you have saved time and you've made a line of least resistance for your will to run into. This way you don't have a fight with yourself about how to succeed. You spontaneously flow towards your objective in proportion to the clarity of your definition. Now, let's suppose for a moment that resistance occurred when you went knocking on doors. Now, a mediating line would then be how to overcome this resistance, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Now you would again have to define yourself, not as a photographer now, but in relation to the concept resistance overcomer. How do you stand as a resistance overcomer?
Well, the suggestion I make is that if they don't have their photograph taken, they're going to miss an opportunity of capturing their children or whatever it is in a particular stage.
That's one of your weapons.
Yes.
Have you got any other more general? Can you generalize that one? What's the fundamental thing we've said about the will of people?
They have to be curved.
And it's already moving in a given direction.
Yes, they either decide in their own minds that they're going to have it or they're not going to have it. You're attempting to kill the one idea and get them to have it.
Yeah, but that's still particularizing. Move backwards to find a general rule. Their will is already moving towards something. What is it? Why does a person have a photograph taken?
Is it to be able to see a particular person at that particular stage.
Are you quite sure about that?
That's the reason they have it taken.
Well, why do people destroy so many photographs that they've taken?
Well, I don't think they do destroy so many of the portrait type. They'll destroy the snap type, and they'll destroy the group type. But from what I've seen, they hang on to the portraits pretty well all over the world.
In my experience, large numbers of women destroy portraits themselves that they don't even when they bought them. When they've been forced sale on them, when they didn't want them because they didn't think they flattered them. You see, they don't want an objective record of what they looked like. They want to be photographed at their best, don't they?
So they want flattering.
Well, they want showing at their best and their worst. So if somebody has no chin, you don't photograph them with the forehead for them, do you? And so on. You have to find the angle, don't you? So that the fundamental principle is that you mustn't make such a picture of the will that the will won't like it because it won't want to pay for it. And if you force sell it, which can be done by negative tricks, I know one firm that went on the tap-tap on the door, photographing people, and then when they didn't like the photographs, which were very bad, they served them and solicited this letter to make them pay up. Now that was a negative technique and not nice. And very bad for long-term business. And this fellow said to me, I won't be here long. You see, he wanted immediate results. So you have to move your particulars back, generalize them, and then look for the universal rule. And the universal rule about an individuated will is that it is self-witnessing. It always wants to be at its optimum. So when you're making your analysis, always try to push your particular illustrations back again. Put them down so you can seize them, then work on them and generalize them, and then feel for the universal rule that covers all such manifestations. It wouldn't matter then whether you were selling concrete or photographs. It's the same rule. If you actually make yourself, discipline yourself to get a piece of paper and write it down, and then always look for the general behind the particular and the universal behind those general. And then you've got a very, very simple tool that will enable you to run through every field of activity. Revert to that magician concept again. An individual man is a finite structure. He starts life as an egg, and the fluids in that egg are rotating. And the forces that cause it to rotate are forces acting in opposition. When two forces oppose each other, they begin to rotate. Now, if we look in the sky at nebular masses of gas and so on, and we look at the spiral nebula, what we see is the same concept. Two forces pressing on a center, causing it to spin. So that we have the same law for the generation of a finite creature on Earth that we have for the large mass of gas like a star group. Namely, that forces pressing on a center unequally will cause it to spin. And the spinning produces a boundary. That's called the firmament. Firmness. Firmament actually means to be hammered out from both sides, and these are opposite forces. And once this rotation is set up, you have then got an isolated being, an individual, and that individual is an individual will. And you will have to deal with that will in a human being as a totally closed system, unable to see anything whatever other than the modifications of its own substance inside its boundaries. So that when you talk to a person, if you talk at the ordinary physical level, you rattle his eardrums with sound, don't you? If a Chinese comes and rattles our eardrums with Chinese sounds, we may find it harder to comprehend what he's talking about than if he rattles them in English. Because inside the brain we have the records of the words and the physical situations that we've learned them in, so that when the eardrums rattle in a certain way, certain images appear in the mind. So that when you are talking to somebody, you should never forget that the words that you are using are rattling their eardrums and stimulating in their mind certain forms, and that the forms that appear in their mind cannot be identical with yours. And it's for this reason that many philosophers think that communication is impossible, because you can only communicate where you are identical. You can approximate to communication where you are nearly identical, and where you are totally dissimilar, there is no communication at all. So So in communicating with somebody, you have to find some common ground. You have to agree on some common terms. So if two men are arguing and one is a technical expert and the other is not, and if it happens that the one who is not is a bit dogged and sticks to his point, at some point in the argument it is quite common for the technical fellow to come out with a flood of technical terms on him and say, and that is that. Finish the argument, blinding with science. When that happens, if the fellow who wasn't technically minded isn't careful, he will accept the conclusion without understanding it, by the sheer weight of the authority. So when we see that this one principle of rotating of energy produces individuation, just like one big egg, the cosmic egg, and then inside the forces are rotating, producing smaller rotations, and those are producing smaller ones, right down to subatomic particles. And when we've got down to the fundamental particles, all made by the first big turn, then we start integrating those primary particles again as atoms, molecules, organic compounds, organs, vegetables, animals, humans, and so on. So first of all, from the big wheel, we cut it up. Like the analogy of mitosis in the egg, we cut the universe up into a star system, a solar system, a planetary system, Earth, break the Earth up into its tiny bits, molecules, atoms, subatomics, and then start integrating them together again as mosses, as molds, as viruses, as bacteria, vegetables, animals, humans, and so on. All the time, this process is going on inside the big wheel of the universe. And from the point of view of an individual man, the whole process is going on inside him as a reflex sphere of the big one. So as we said before, the big one, the microcosm, experience of resistance from someone, you've been partially responsible for setting it up.
If resistance exists, how about if you off you and bring yourself to a position where you're agreeing with that person, then agreeing with them about something that they're resisting.
Well, let me give you a concrete example. A red skeleton type of salesman that I knew many, many years ago, who decided for research purposes, and actually he was a behaviorist, and he was tremendously interested in the mechanics of the nervous system. So he decided to go on a tour for research, door to door, and see what happened if he fainted on the doorstep. See? So that when the door opened, the woman didn't see a flash salesman there ready. As she opened the door, a man trampled up and fell on the floor. You see? Now, as soon as that happened, she panicked. She asked him what was the matter, he couldn't reply. You see? She rushed in the house, got assistance and a glass of water. They brought him a chair, they set it up. They asked him what he was doing. He said he was selling. They asked him what he was selling. They gave themselves all the sales line necessary. You see? Now why was that? The answer was he had made himself inferior to them. As she saw him fall to the ground, suddenly she felt far bigger than he was. She was put in a position of great strength. Something terrible had happened, and here was she, strong to deal with it. She brought special assistance for technical advice and so on, but she was there first. She would be able to talk to the neighbours later, you see. Now, naturally, he couldn't do that next door, so he had to travel quite long distances in between. But he proved his point, that he never failed to make good big sales by collapsing on the doorstep. You see? So where there is a resistance, it means that you have put a sufficient percentage of that resistance up. But you mustn't assume you put it all up, because the law of the association of ideas says, if a salesman looking like you last week came down and was very rude, when she opens the door and sees your face looking like his, you'll have a hard job to make a sale. So you have to, if you see such a reaction, you forget the goods, and you say to her, you look rather startled when you saw me, don't you like my face? Does it remind you of something you don't like? And so on. You question her about it. You're pursuing the truth as a good experimental salesman. They've done a lot of very, very good research into behaviourists in America on this, where, similar to Gorlock polls, they have done all these various techniques on people to discover what is their fundamental reaction. Now, that reaction is identical with the reaction of an amoeba. That is, there is something it likes and something it doesn't like. It doesn't like a bit of lemon juice to have near it. It does like a certain amount of sugary food particles to have near it, will flow towards it. So you can actually steer a course for it and for a human being, in so far as he's not reflexively self-conscious, which means most human beings. Being is either free or not, and if he's not free, he is conditioned. And if you understand the conditions, you can determine his activity. So the whole thing is to liberate yourself from those conditions, those established motions of your own body, your own mind, your own emotional drift. And that you can only do by understanding yourself, which means by defining yourself. Why is that?
What's the principle?
Well, that's what they've got used to hearing. A particular commodity, they've got used to a certain price with a certain commodity, and if yours is different, they wonder why. It's either a catch or something wrong.
Can you reduce that to a fundamental energy problem? If a person is learning to play the piano and they do five-finger exercises,
yes.
Supposing they play five notes through a diatonic scale up and five back again, and they practice for 4 hours so that they can do that very, very quickly, it does not confer upon them the ability to play thirds instead alternately.
No,
you
just do that.
Every practice confers only the ability to do that, not something else. The old faculty psychology didn't believe that. It thought that if you learned one skill, that you'd become clever in all sorts of things. It isn't true. Every skill is only itself. Riding a bicycle won't make you able to swim. Making you able to swim won't teach you to sing. And so, each skill is special. In other words, every form of behavior that you acquire is peculiar to itself. So that if you get a conditioned reflex, like the reaction of a person that Christ stated, it is a definite amount of energy running in a definite pattern in the organism. Now, if you change the price, don't think of it as price, you have changed the quality of the stimulus. The chain cannot respond. Now, you may think that they're feeling suspicious, and they may think so. What they're feeling is uneasy, because you've liberated energy into them that has no pattern to respond to it.
This refers to the grooves, I
think. That's right. And it's essential to get right down to this fundamental principle. It doesn't matter what people think they are doing when you tell them something like that. The important thing is this. When you stimulate somebody, you add energy to their existing pattern. If the pattern is such that it can assimilate that energy, they feel pleased. And if the pattern is such that the energy you put in cannot be assimilated, it must be an irritant. So they turn away. Therefore, even big firms, instead of altering their prices, like reducing them, which they can do sometimes, they don't do it that way, because it would make people feel funny. What they can do is capitalize on the will's desire for evermore, evermore, by giving a free 5-shilling voucher instead. You see, that seems logical. It's a voucher system. So instead of reducing the price 5 shillings, which would make them suspicious, they give them a free voucher for the same amount. And they feel all right because they've got a piece of paper that says free voucher on it.
So what you start to do is cease to play with the materials and play with the energy behind.
Play with the energy behind. And it's the same in every field. You're up against this mark, this primary drive, and the form that it takes has already been partially set by the time you come across that individual. So you study the form that is there, and then you feed the energy into the form that can receive it. The most blatant and obvious case of it is you wouldn't try to sell a handful of brushes in English if you were selling in, say, Vienna, would you? You wouldn't do very well. You'll have to get somebody with the same language. Now, everybody knows that of language, but they don't realize it of vocabulary. Within English, there are many languages. You know that Shakespeare uses, in emotive passages, Saxon root words. But where he doesn't want to disturb your deep emotions, he uses Latin extractions. Because the Latin words go here, because we had a scholastic heritage from the Roman Church. And Latin was an intellectual language. Therefore, many of the words in English that signify intellectual things are Latin words. Whereas the simple primary monosyllables of Saxon belong down here, Latin belongs up there. You see? So if you were to go to a girl and say, I have an amorous inclination towards you, amorous inclination being Latin, it wouldn't hit her in the right place, would it? You have to go down to your Saxon, don't you?
As a matter of fact, talking about that, I found that if you state that you're doing it in the home portrait and they look at you blankly, and if you say you're taking photographs in the home, they'll come forward.
That's the whole point. A lot of bad salesmanship consists of trying to make the thing a quality job, and all they do is make it incomprehensible. In research that we did with working class people, and particularly with girls, any word with more than two syllables in it produced a snicker. No matter what it was. A three-syllable word, you have been tremendously clever. Actually, the word tremendous was one. If somebody said tremendous, hark at him. You see, two syllables is the top, and one is better. And the two-syllable ones are all swear words in any case. See? And if you want to be understood by them, then you must cut it down. The nearer to the monosyllable, the better. If you're selling photography or anything else to working-class people, talk Saxon. Because they cannot understand anything else.
But are you conditioning yourself to that vocabulary?
That vocabulary must be one of your weapons. You can learn another vocabulary as well, independently in your spare time. Can you?
But you're liable to be doing that most of the time.
How many hours a day are there?
Well,
24. How many hours would you be selling?
Eight.
How many are left?
Well, actually, you'd be selling six.
How many are left? You should be able to find enough time to practice the other things and the rest of the time. So if I gave you a 24-inch ruler and said cut it into three bits and sleep eight, work eight, and recreate eight, that would be a sufficient working tool, wouldn't it? What a mason would call a working tool. Recreation does not mean fool about. It means recreate yourself. It really means recreate yourself. Fooling about in a cinema four times a week, for instance, is not recreation. You could call it schlockification if you like, but it isn't recreation. It removes certain tensions that are derived through being under authority all day, but it doesn't do anything else. It doesn't recreate. It just puts them back in the splurge that they were in before they went to work that day. Recreate means that you create yourself again, and create means to formulate. And you know, a change is as good as a rest, isn't it?
Yes.
So even if you're perfectly fatigued on one subject, mentally, when you come to work another subject, you find that you're not tired on that subject. Although you presume that you're using the same brain for the two occupations. You're not actually using the same frequency band.
So you would say that you
quite different.
If you change your occupation, you prefer a woman today.
Oh, yes.
How about the sleeping?
Well, you'd be surprised that most of your sleep is spent in non-creative mentation. You may not be able to remember it, but there are processes going on that you would call dreaming if you could remember them all. And most of them are destructive, particularly for a modern civilized man. Definitely not. You know what? Yes. You know what happens when you use a muscle for a long time? The muscle becomes poisoned by the byproducts of its own activity.
Yes.
And that poison insulates it, so it can't receive those nervous impulses properly. Then you say it is tired because it's difficult to use it. Now, if I do that on my right arm, it doesn't tire my left arm. In exactly the same way, if I tire myself in certain ideas, it will not tire some other ideas. So in the same way that a muscle tires by poisoning itself with the byproducts of its own activity, so an idea system is poisoned by the byproducts of the interrelations of the impulses that constitute it. Well, a very old Chinese saying said that if a man were to know the truth, and he knew it only in one way, he would be a dead man. You see, now truth equals form. If you knew form, that is truth. Cosmic form is truth. If you knew that truth in only one way, you'd be in a groove. You'd be dead, technically. All the great religious teachers would say, he's a dead man, he's in a groove. And therefore it says that truth without elasticity is no good. And the only way you can get elasticity with your truth is in discussion with other people. In other words, different ways of stating the same thing, different points of view. Our six systems keep swapping, going from one to the other. Refuse to identify with any one of them. And keep circulating around them. Circulation is the same as life. Circulation in the body of the blood is the same as life. If you stop the blood in any part of the body, that part will begin to die. If you put a tourniquet on your arm and forget you've got it on, your arm will die, won't it? So this process of circulation is a method of removing the byproducts, the toxic byproducts of activity, isn't it? So if you stop circulation in any given place, the poisons accumulate there and are not carried away. You can actually get a headache by thinking about one subject for too long. And that part of you, dealing with it, becomes surcharged with energy, and then it is intoxicated with the byproducts of its own thinking process, and you get a headache. At that point, a change of subject will remove the headache.
But as I see what you said, if you start to work on things from the basic energy behind all the time, you're not really identifying with one subject at all. You'd be behind all that.
On this subject, the cosmic subject, as opposed to parts of the subject. Photography is a part of the problem of the relation between light and silver, isn't it?
Yes.
If silver didn't go dark, there wouldn't be any photography. So that there's something bigger than mere camera business, isn't it? Camera means a room, doesn't it? You need a little dark room. Why? To exclude the light that you don't want. The camera is an insulator. It keeps out light that you don't want. You drill a hole in one end to let light in from a specific direction. And all that happens is that light darkens the silver on the emulsion, doesn't it? And that's all photography is. So it's a very simple principle. Now, it took them a few thousand years for it to click that a certain substance which they had been digging for years goes dark when it gets in the light. And it waited for a man to leave something on a piece of silver like that, accidentally, and come back a few hours later, picked it up, There was the shape of that thing there. Good gracious, this heat's photography. You see? And straight away he began to isolate. First he put leaves on the silver plate. He got a silhouette of the leaf. And afterwards he sort of put it in a box and see where I'll get. Then he noticed that the curtains, when they're drawn, and leave a tiny little gap, will sometimes throw an image on the wall of what's outside. And the pinhole camera was born. Then he put a piece of glass in between, like a drop of water originally. And that was a lens, so called because it was the same shape as a seed. And these are fundamental principles that people can't get at usually because they're in a groove. That could have been invented before by a man who wasn't in the groove. So instead of waiting for accidents to happen like that, if you step out of the particular and find the universal, you'll discover that there are things you can do anachronistically, that is, before everybody else does them.
When you start to work on this principle of going back to fundamentals all the time, you're linking all these groups.
That's right. That's the fundamental idea. When Plotinus said of this, you have to start with your particulars because they are given to you. Those are your primary sense data. And then you begin to look for the similars in them. And all the similar ones you tie together. And you say that is a class because it's grouped by similar. And then you look for what is similar in the groups of similars. And you make a superclass out of it. And you go on doing this until you come to the top class, which is the concept of being itself. Now, what Plotinus said about that was this. A man has become identified with his physical body only because sense organs are being stimulated from outside. And consider an egg. It has its own impulsive nature and it is producing inside itself self-stimulation, but very gently. And when the sense stimulus comes from outside, it is stronger than the internal stimulus, so it overlays it. The internal stimulus in an egg, before fertilization in the egg in a woman, is already a type of conscious awareness of itself, and the same in the sperm. When those two come together and the process of mingling of inverituments occurs, this egg still knows what is going on, but it can't yet say so verbally, because it hasn't yet evolved the mouth. But all the formal possibilities are there in the sphere, but they're very, very gently pulsating on themselves. Then when it's born, the five sense organs are hammered from outside by light and sound and so on, and the external origin stimuli crowd over and obscure the internal one. And from that moment, the child has lost its innocence. The child is innocent as long as it's aware of its own processes inside. But when the external stimulation obscures the internal process, it is no longer innocent, it is called ignorant. You change the word innocence into ignorance by simply putting a hard ga, the gamma, which means to say that it is now overloaded. And the whole art of life then consists in regaining your innocence, which is the same thing as your inner awareness, which you have to do by cutting down on the attention to the external world stimulus. So the whole of the mystical process in all religions consists of cutting down on your five sense organ stimulation reaction. Your five senses are stimulated, you tend to rush out and see what's going on. And when you do that, the stimulation is greater from outside than it is from inside. Therefore, you don't know yourself. And when you introvert, turn your energies inward and keep very, very quiet and ignore the memories from your five senses, you then recontact your primary self-awareness. This is what Plato called the epistrophe, the back-turning of consciousness onto itself. And this is the absolute precondition of freedom for anybody, that he must be able to turn back on himself and liberate himself from the mechanical determination of the five senses.
Is this what's meant by the statement, action within action?
Yes. In the Tao Te Ching, to act without action, is to cut off the external action and discover the internal action. And when the internal tells you to do something, it is never wrong.
because it has a whole feeling for the situation. You see, a mathematician making statistical surveys cannot deal with an individual. He only deals with large numbers. The greater the number, the more sure his forecasts. He cannot forecast a single man, whereas he can forecast roughly how many pools entrants there will be in the coming year. You see, statistically. But he can't say whether you're going to go in for a change. So the individual is never covered by mathematical statistical analysis. But if you can get hold of the internal feeling of an individual, then you can tell what he's going to do. Because he's already biased in a certain direction to do with his personal evolution. So really the method of helping somebody is to find out where they're trying to go. Pick up their feeling. Don't think about them. Feel about them first. Feel for their directions and allow those feelings to formulate, and never use anything you've learned from your five senses to diagnose. In diagnosis, if you turn to this department in your training, you're only referring to the memory of the things of the past. You are not referring to the present condition of your patient. But if you feel the patient and let the patient's feeling come at you and deliberately inhibit the mental processes from your five sense organs, there will arise in you a tendency to say something. And you should not inhibit it. You should say it and see what the patient says. After a bit, you become quite sure that what has come in you is right, because the number of times the patient is shocked by your discovery of the cause of what is wrong with them will convince you. Well, psychic only means feeling. You see, the psyche is the soul, and the soul is sentience, feeling. If you refine your feeling and cut out the five sense overload, you are actually cosmically aware. In this room, there are radio waves. As long as you attend to your physical ear, this one, you can't hear them. But if you quieten yourself, you can hear radio waves. A couple of years ago, there was a boy. Do you remember that, don't you, Ken? A boy discovered he was being annoyed by radio programs, picking up two stations at once. He hadn't got a radio set. But he'd become, through introversion, sensitive at that level. And his parents said, well, it's a kind of nuisance to him, so they took him to the doctor, and it was decided to help him by giving him some drug treatment, which in effect lowered his frequency. And then he couldn't hear them anymore. They were still there. Now, it isn't difficult to see how that happened. An ordinary crystal set is not different in kind from the mineral salts in your blood. And you know that every salt has its own frequency. So that when you're talking about crystals, even rheumatism itself, you see, is a mode of response if you concentrate on it. Some people get so very, very sensitive who are rheumatic that they can tell you if it's going to rain, can't they? And they're not pulling your leg. They know it. Because these little things are picking up overloads of electricity.
It's attuned to a frequency of energy.
Oh, yes. Every crystal has a very definite frequency band to which it is always in tune. If you concentrate it in your own center, and ignore your five sense external stimulus, and just feel for that, you'll begin to see, to hear, to smell, and so on, without using your five sense organs. Remember, these five sense organs are called special senses. If you look at the growth of an egg into a human being, at certain stages you will see, in the case of the eye, for instance, you see a peculiar process growing up and forward, like a cup. And it spreads out, and it goes in, and leaves a thing. It's spreading out like that and going in and leaving a ball in the middle. And that initial growth and back pull becomes the eyelids. You see, vision precedes the special organ of vision. Vision is only the reception of certain kind of electromagnetic waves. This, like the iris of a camera, is only a special way of insulating. You don't want to see the absolute. You want to see where your dinner is. And if you didn't have special sense organs, you would be absolutely conscious. That is to say, you'd be totally indiscriminate. You would know everything and trip over the carpet. Like we said last week, if you were sensitive to infrared rays, you wouldn't be able to see the edges of people, so you couldn't hit them. Or you couldn't even give them anything. Understand, to pop a sweet into a child's mouth, if all you could see was a red cloud, you might stick it in the child's ear by mistake. And say, restriction of sensitivity to the five sense organs. It's a mode of insulation again. All creations, all forms, are attempts to step down the absolute consciousness, omniscience of God, down to a workable level.
From that, I draw the idea that while you're living within your sense perceptions, that you're actually dissipating what power you have at lower frequencies.
That's right. The less you have to do with your five senses, the better. So that if you do have something to do with them, you should always do it specifically. This is the doctrine of immediacy again. When Christ says, sufficient for the day is the evil thereof, keep your mind on what you are doing when you've got to do it. So if there's a gross material situation there, concentrate on it and do it accurately. And when there isn't one, don't waste your time doing that. Go back to your primary innocence. Regain your wholeness. You know that modern neurosis is no more than disintegration to excessive stimulation. Stimuli going into your body cut it up into bits. That's like the Simeon and Levy function we mentioned before. Simeon and Levy digged a wall and slew a man to their own hurt. That means the perception and the emotion. Simeon is that emotional life. Levy is that perceptive life. When the light hits me in the eye, that happens to be a golden yellowish light, very pleasant, you see. That it hits me in the eye is Levy. That it makes me feel very pleasant is Simeon. And it's making me partial. That is, while I'm enjoying that, I've forgotten that I've got 10 ingrowing toenails and 2 calluses on my elbows, or something like that. You see, it overshadows other partial. Well, in general, that is true. It's, you know, there is a typology. Well, let's consider the nervous system as an organ of command, a negative process, controlling the will. The will tends to spread out, you see? And its primary aim before education is pleasure. So we would find that the pleasurable parts of the body, the front of the body, the lower part of the body are soft, aren't they? You wouldn't think of taking the back part with the 2 shoulder blades, the spinal column, and the bones at the back of the pelvis, and putting those to the back of another person and saying, isn't it lovely? You see? The sensuous part is on the front and low. The bones themselves, the formal parts, are not sensuous. So that if a person thinks sensuously, he thinks forward and down. And then the paunch begins to spread. So according to the way a person is biased, if they're biased towards sensuality, they will tend to increase the surfaces that are fatty and comfortable, because they're seeking for pleasures. On the other hand, if they decide that they'd rather have truth, they start pulling backwards and upwards, spinal nerves and into the head. And thereupon, the energies, instead of flowing down and forward, flowing backwards, do not deposit tissue forward and downwards. So you tend to get a slimmer type of person.
It's getting to function and form, isn't it?
Function and form. Function creates form. Form is the objectification of a function. A power moving in a certain way, functioning in a certain way, crystallizes itself, and that is the form. So in the case of the appearance of an organic disease, before it's an organic breakdown, it is first a functional disorder. Before it's a functional disorder, it is a disposition of the will. It doesn't matter how many years it takes to break an organ down, it starts with an attitude in the will. That will conditions a certain behavior pattern in the emotive life, and that pattern, that functional pattern, is the basis of the loading of matter. And as matter is loaded onto that function, the organ, the working matter, is then objectifying the state of the function. So if the function is bad, we say that the organ has become diseased. You can't have a sudden organic breakdown without a previous functional fault. And you can't have that without some maladjustment in the feeling, with the exception of such things as being run over by a bus or deliberately pouring poison down your gullet or tapping yourself with hammers and so on. Apart from the mere mechanical activities, all diseases, without exception, have their origin in an initial state of the will producing a function of the feeling. That function, continuing over a long period, produces distortions in the organ and ultimately breakdown of the organ.
So really speaking, to cure disease, you should be operating
on the will. The prevention of disease is more important than the cure of it, isn't it? The prevention of it consists, when you see the first signs of someone beginning to worry, you say, if you're lucky enough, don't worry. Worry wears tissue down. If a dog worries a bone, we mean that it's not doing it any good. From the point of view of its form, it's breaking it down. If a person worries about any part of their body, they are literally malfunctioning that part. And if they persist, there'll be an organic breakdown. You can prove it very simply yourself. If you rub your finger and thumb together like that, by active will, first the will, then the function, and keep on doing it, and you'll wear the skin down, won't you? You see that in the case of a horse, where somebody's got the horse in a cart, and he's pulling on the collar on the shoulder here, and he doesn't particularly care, and he doesn't fit very well. Every time the horse pulls, which it does as it's commanded, and its urge manifests, and then the collar, its physical fact, and its physical body, are brought into functional relationship, and then the tissue is worn down. Now sometimes when it gets very sore, the horse refuses to pull. That is, its will gives up. It says, I don't like this kind of objectification. So then the owner of the horse puts a pad under it and curses the horse. Really, he should have prevented it, shouldn't he? And this is without exception. If a person is not made ill by a mechanical fact, like being run over by a bus or dropped on by a couple of houses or swallowing poisons, or eating bad food, which is the same thing, really. Apart from merely external, mechanical and physical things acting on the body, all diseases, without exception, have their origin in the will. And therefore, the key to the prevention of future diseases is putting the will of that person right. And the first condition of that, of course, is that condition called positivity to life, faith. Hope that it'll be all right. Have faith that it will be all right, and the function of the organism is improved.
So the disease can be cured and without
creation. Oh, yeah. Remember that root ma. It's the same thing as mama. You know? Mama gives the drive and the substance. Papa gives the form. You see?
Is this controlled by the egg?
Can I make something? I'm getting a bit cold. That many times. Over periods covering up to 50 years. wire with the initial tendency there and the environment such that it's very unlikely that other forces are going to stop that kind of function. It is possible to predict that that person will go that way. You see, primary egotism is a wonderful thing. If a man is going to the South Pole in a pond, and you meet him wandering towards the North Pole, and you say to him, you've lost your direction, you're going towards the North Pole, the average man will look at you and say, mind your own business. And you will carry on over the North Pole and go right down to the South Pole. But you won't turn back. This tendency to self-witness is so strong. So very often a person is committed to a course which they feel is wrong. And if you indicate it to them directly, they'll carry on with it. Now, doubly certain it's going to happen, because you've had the nerve to mention it. That's like consciousness is a catalyst. Somebody may be unaware, consciously, that they're doing a certain thing. If you blatantly say, you are going to do so-and-so, suddenly they become aware that that's their intention. And although they know it is wrong, they will carry on doing it, because you've exposed it. And if they were to change their course, it would be to admit that you were right and that they had chosen the wrong direction. And rather than admit that they were wrong, they will carry on with the direction, even to the point of view of personal suffering.
Most people like the term.
Yeah. Well, most people are that inertic. Mm. It's not a question of free will, it's a question of inertia. William Blake once looked at a man and he said, that man will hang. And some years later, that man was hanged. Now, it wasn't a guess. What he saw was the intent on the part of that man to murder, plus not very great intelligence to dodge the consequences.
Seems like we ought to, if this is true, we ought to concentrate on studying your own will and nature of it. That seems to be the key, huh?
Yes. It's the only key. Self-examination will reveal that you have committed yourself. We can say this without qualifications for everybody on earth, that every individual has committed himself, if he hasn't already examined himself, he's committed himself to something that is foolish, harmful to himself, and which when he looks at it for the first time and decides it's no good, at the same time he will not want to stop it. Because he has committed himself to it. He's written his name on it. I'm going to do that, he says. Sometimes you see a little boy lifting a big stone up, and it's hurting his muscles, and he can feel it, but he won't stop, because he's determined to lift that stone. Sometimes a man ruptures himself by doing a display of strength in a pub with some other fellows. Someone is a bit strong, another fellow's not going to be beaten. Result, a rupture. It may mean 15 years of some suffering resulting in an intestinal stoppage or something like that. But his will is determined. The Stoics were so aware of that that in one case Epictetus describes a man in bed who says he's going to die. Why are you going to die? I'm determined, says he. And there's a lovely dialogue about the determination of this man to die. Is it good to die and so on? Is it better to live? There's a long dialogue and this man, I'm determined to die. I was in a hospital today, and a patient said to me, it's an abdominal operation, not a highly complicated one, just a little bypassing of an adhesion. Now, this person said, I would rather die than live as I am now. I feel like an animal. I feel dependent on a merely physical thing for the first time in my life, and I would rather die. And that person has lost 2 stones in a week. Through sheer negativity. If I'd have had only that wrong with me, with the experiences I'd have had, it wouldn't have made me want to die. I'd have just said, all right, I'll accept it. I'll cut down on my food for the time being. I won't overload myself. And I'll have a bit of patience and have so-and-so done and treat it like a man treats an old car, an old crock. Nurse it. But when a person has never been ill throughout life and... material gain. Remember that discussion we had? Well, we have to decide which expedients are we going to follow. We cannot do both. You cannot serve God and mammon. That is to say, you cannot serve the two expediencies simultaneously. You'll have to choose at any given moment, am I working towards integration or cash? Because frequently they conflict. It is possible to alternate very carefully, to go out and work and get sufficient for your daily bread in a disintegrating occupation. Silicosis or something. You might have to. You might spend the rest of your time doing breathing exercises, making yourself healthy. And I went down a big pit at Haydock once with a solicitor friend of mine, one of the deepest pits in the country. We went down there and all over the place, and little tunnels this high with men lying on their backs chipping away. And those men were full of coal dust. That was for their daily bread. Some did overtime. When they came up again, they had a bath and they drank beer. By the pint, I've never seen men drink so much, to get rid of the coal dust. Well, they didn't get it out of the lungs that way. But those who were a bit brighter than that breathed and coughed and did all sorts to get rid of the dust. They wanted to be healthy as well as earn their living. And we have to decide at any given moment whether we are serving a higher expediency, the movement towards personal integration, or the lower one, mere subsistence in the material world.
Work on the theory of expediency with the one aim of self-integration, you get it made.
You're bound to succeed.
When you spoke about will, and will being used to such a degree that a person can injure himself with it.
Yeah.
trying to better someone else's performance. Does that mean that there mustn't be any kind of competition?
Well, it means
either commercial type competition or even sporting competition.
No, it doesn't mean that.
Because those men in competition are really pressing themselves to the limit, aren't they?
They may do. You see, it's possible for a man to kill himself. Running a 3.5 minute mile, isn't it? We know very well that when those records are extended, they're extended at a cost to individuals, aren't they? But if the cost is too big, it isn't worth it. Some people make it, don't they? Caruso bust a blood vessel in his throat. It was bad voice production, apart from everything else, he shouldn't have done it. That didn't improve the tone, it ruined the tone, didn't it? You have to use your intelligence, and when you're running a horse over the jumps, it isn't as safe as running on the flat, is it?
No.
So there's more trouble over the jumps, and if you're taking special skills like that, you should be very, very careful not to push your organism too far too soon, because it will break down, and then you've undone the work you're trying to do. You can actually play the piano in your exercises, say 8 hours, 10 hours, 12, 14, like a big player might, and you might say, I've done 14 hours, tomorrow I'll do 16, and this has actually happened with a fellow I know, and the next day his forearm would not move at all. He'd overdone it. And it was 18 months before he could play again. You see, he'd driven that muscle to the point of complete intoxication. And the result was that the nerves from his higher centers had said, that is stupid, so they cut it off.